Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show. I am your host, Dan Breslin, and this is episode 128 with Hakeem Valez on real estate investing after the NFL. After retiring from professional football just a few weeks ago, Hakeem and I had a chance to catch up here on the show about his real estate investing and, more importantly, the mindset he's used first to get into the NFL and later to build momentum now in the real estate arena. This will be an interesting episode, as I'm sure you've already assumed, so we might as well jump right in. All right, welcome to the show, Hakeem.
Thanks for having me, Dan. I appreciate you having me on your show, brother.
For sure. I'll first put a little word of warning out there. Some of my regular listeners know I live in the condo on the lake in Michigan, and they're always doing construction this time of year, so if you hear the drills rattling and stuff like that, I apologize. We're going to have to roll with the punches and keep it moving. But just to get a sense, where are you recording from? Where are you at in the world today, Hakeem?
I'm in New Jersey currently, in South Jersey. I'm actually headed out your way to Michigan tomorrow evening. I have a keynote speech on Friday in Dearborn.
Nice. For anyone listening who doesn't already know who you are, do you want to give kind of the background story, who you were, what happened early on to get to where you're at, maybe like a brief description of what your business looks like today in real estate?
Absolutely. So, my name is Hakeem Valles. I've always had a passion for just being an entrepreneur. If you take it back to when I was a kid, I fifth grade, I used to bug my older brother to drive me around neighborhood to neighborhood because we had a pickup truck to go cut grass at different houses so I could make a little bit of money. And then I went to middle school and my mom had a Sam's Club card and, I knew that a box of Skittles cost $13, but there was 36 bags of Skittles in it. So I used to resell the Skittles for a dollar each in middle school. So I'd go to school with two backpacks, one with Skittles in it and one with my books in it, and go get my hustle. And that's how I bought my first cell phone. Progressing forward. High school, I kind of didn't really have time to be an entrepreneur. I went to boarding school for high school, and we had school 6 days a week. So it was very busy and rigorous, but it was an amazing experience. It helped me forcibly surround myself with an excellent network of great people. And then as I went from high school into college, my little brother had cracked his iPhone about for like the fifth or sixth time, and my dad was like, I'm not fixing it anymore. It's ridiculous. You keep breaking your phone. So I said, let me check it out. And, went on YouTube and it took me about 6 hours to fix his phone, but it only cost me $30. And at the end, it actually turned on and it actually worked. And I was like, ding, like a light just went off in my head. And I was like, wow, I could actually make money doing this. So I took apart my phone and put it back together and went from 6 hours to being able to do it in 20 minutes. And when I went to college my freshman year, I was the iPhone repair guy. You know, my spread was about 30 bucks a phone, and it was awesome. And then like my mind kind of just kept going deeper and deeper into that. So I realized that I could sell all of my cracked screens to a recycle company in Alabama for $5 a screen. So I would take all my cracked screens and send them out to Alabama. Then I was like, you know what? Let me go and talk to all the local iPhone repairsmen in the area and see if they're willing to sell me their crack screens. So I would go to them, buy all their screens for about $2 to $2.50 a screen, and then go and ship them off to Alabama for $5 a screen. Like, you should have seen my college room. It was filled up with a whole bunch of just boxes and bubble wrap. Cause that was my thing. I was a quick niche, but the iPhone 6 actually put me out of business cause it cost too much to fix. And the parts for it. It was a very, very complicated fix. So that's what kind of knocked me out of that game. But while I was in college, my degree is actually in business with a concentration in real estate. I went to Monmouth University. It's one of the few schools in the country that even offer that major. And while I was doing that in the classroom, the girl I was dating at the time, her dad had just started his own house flipping business. And he decided, he said, hey, you know, you're going to college for, you know, real estate. Why don't, you know, I take you under my wing and, you know, show you what I'm doing. And he was kind of very new at it as well. But his first cousin was a contractor. So it was an awesome relationship because while I was in school, I purposely scheduled my classes at 6 o'clock at night. So from 6 in the morning to about noon, I would be up in North Jersey, you know, knocking down walls, making offers on pre-foreclosures, driving for dollars, doing a whole bunch of stuff that I didn't even know what I was doing. I was just young and eager to learn and help. And it was kind of cool because I kind of got like a rich dad, poor dad education while doing it, because it was like in the classroom, I'm learning how to be an employee at like a big commercial real estate firm. And then in the field, I was actually out there ripping and running and making moves. And it was cool. I was coming back to the classroom, but you know, sometimes I make some snarky comments like, I don't necessarily want to do this or be this person. Can you show me how to be the owner of this? And, it kind of got a little bit of, you know, a little bit of backlash in class and I used to do that, but it was an awesome experience. So as I kind of progressed, so while I was in college, you know, playing Division I football, I was actually a bench player. So I legitimately did not see the field from 2011 to 2015, 2014. You know, I rode the bench and it was, you know, it sucked. It was rough, but I really trust the process and really, you know, honed into what delayed gratification meant. And I knew that I was good enough to play. And so my senior year, I made the switch from being a wide receiver and moved to becoming a tight end. And that move was awesome. You know, first game, I had my first catch. Second game, had my first touchdown and kind of started every game after that. And got awarded a fifth season. So like when I went to grad school, because I redshirted my freshman year, they allowed me to play for a fifth year, which was awesome. And at that time, my little brother, he's currently in the CFL for the Ottawa Redblacks, he had gotten drafted to the Oakland Raiders. So that was when I had that moment of, wow, you know, if he can do it, I can do it. You know, you have siblings. I'm sure you understand where I'm coming from. You know, you grow up with this kid your entire life and know that, you know, everything that, you know them in and out. So, you know, like if that person can do it, just that competitive nature of me, I knew that I could do the same exact thing. And it was actually that summer where I had a turning point in my life that really changed and shifted the paradigm of kind of everything. I was on a missionary trip with my mom, my dad, my grandma, and some nurses from Villanova University. And we were giving out medicine to different orphanages and churches across the country in Haiti. I'm Haitian, so it was a beautiful experience really getting to get in touch with my Haitian roots and my Haitian background and seeing the country for what it is. It was a beautiful thing. And then until it was May 29th, 2015, it was me, my mom. My mom was back in her room. She had just got done playing cards. It was me and three other missionaries. We were playing spades. It's a card game at about 2:30 in the morning, just having a good time. We had opened up our steel door and deadbolt to let like a breeze come in. And while we were playing, all of a sudden you hear this loud pow. And, you know, my initial reaction was you ever seen those electric fly swatters?
Yeah.
I initially thought it was one of those, just because, you know, there's a bunch of bugs in Haiti and like I kind of froze up, but in reality it was a gunshot. Someone shot through the front door and then kicks down the screen door and eight bandits come in behind him. There's a guy sitting across the table from me. He saved my life by jumping across the table, tackling me out of my chair, because that guy who shot through the front door then turned at us and shot at us. So there's bullet holes in the wall and we're on the ground right below them. That same guy comes and flips over the table. There's a girl next to us. She had a shawl on. They rip it into pieces and tie us up. So I'm hogtied, tied up my wrists, tied up my ankles, hands tied to my feet, and then blindfolded. And essentially, you know, I thought that was the end of my life. You know, I came to peace with the fact that I was going to die. And the only thing that kind of brought me a little bit of joy is that my little brother had just gotten drafted to the NFL about 2 weeks prior. And I knew that, you know, he was going to go on to live on his dream. And I was just grateful that he wasn't on the trip with us. So the bandits, I mean, they went room to room and stole everything. You know, within that process, they had punched one woman in the face. They had attempted to rape another lady. It was a terrible, terrible, traumatic experience. But I say that to say it really, like, overcoming that trauma is what, like, essentially led me to my journey to the NFL and turned me into the person who I am today. Because, you know, I came out of that, I truly understood the value of life and, you know, the value of just taking advantage of every single day, because you truly don't know when it's your last. As cliche as it sounds, I've actually lived through it. But when it comes to actually boosting me and making me able to go to the NFL, it came down to, like, my training aspect. Nothing could break me. Like, honestly, most things just can't break me. There's nothing as bad as laying in your own urine, blindfolded and hogtied, knowing that these are probably your last moments of your life. So when I can at any moment take my brain, my mind to that place, and instantly snap out of whatever complaining I was doing, you know, whatever, oh, this workout is hard, or, oh, I'm stressed out because, you know, I'm busy because I got to, you know, evaluate all these properties or things like that. It puts things in, like, an insane, like, level of perspective. So that all happened, and I went and transitioned to my fifth year, and I balled out that year when it comes to football. And I knew that I had an opportunity to go to the NFL. I essentially, you know, sacrificed everything that I was to become who I wanted to be. You know, had to, you know, change up different friend circles, change up what I did during my free time and really just grind. And what happened was, you know, I was awarded an opportunity to go train at a really nice training facility in New Jersey. And during that process, the commute to that place was about an hour and a half, and we had an hour for lunch. So my total commute for the day was 3 hours, and for another hour for lunch was about 4 hours of dead time. And at that time, so this is January of 2016. At that time, I had put my MBA on hold. I got about 10 credits to go to finish my MBA. So it was January, the draft was in April, and that was when I really had that, oh crap moment. Like, if football does not work out, like, what are you about to do? There's no going back to your dorm room. There's no going back and living with all your friends from, you know, Lincoln Court, you know, the place I lived at in college. There's no more of that. It was essentially like, you either got this NFL or you're going home to go live with your parents. So I essentially, I mean, for 4 months straight, for 4 hours a day, I started consuming an insane amount of just real estate knowledge. You know, I got that degree in business real estate, you know, learning about, it was kind of cool learning about, you know, cap rates and stuff like that as an 18 and 19 year old, you know, college student, but really digging into the entrepreneurial aspect of it and actually listening. You know, that was back when I actually found, I'm sure you're a listener of Bigger Pockets. And started to, you know, really hone in some of the concepts that they were, you know, teaching and talking about on that show. I mean, literally 4 hours a day until you're about to throw up of just information, just kind of coming in, audiobooks, podcasts, and just figuring out what's going to be my niche if football doesn't work out. And then, you know, thankfully I went undrafted to the Arizona Cardinals. And I just remember thinking, like, you know, Phoenix, that's a great city. You know, it's got a good job growth and things like that, a solid population. They got a big college there. I think I should be good investing there. It'll be, you know, it'll be cool. And I was kind of nice. Instantly just smacked with, like, learning an NFL playbook and becoming, you know, acclimated to that whole lifestyle. And I knew, like, at the beginning, I was like, I'm not going to be able to invest. Like, I'm probably going to have to wait until I'm done playing football. And it was kind of a scary moment, but it was just like me being just realistic with myself. And then I had to start paying rent. So one thing about most NFL guys, and I learned from my little brother, he had gotten, when he left the Oakland Raiders and went to the Buffalo Bills, he was locked in on a 6 months still left on his lease in San Francisco. So he was paying like $3,000 a month. So that $18,000 was just essentially just going to just air, like nothing. And I was like, I can't let that happen to me. So I was living at that point in a month-to-month apartment, but it was $2,000 a month. So it's kind of the same exact thing. I'm like, man, $24,000 this year is going to go to air. I mean, I lived in that apartment for maybe 2 to 3 months. And what I did was essentially I made a post on Bigger Pockets in the local forums just saying, you know, my name's Akeem Vallis. I'm a new tight end on the Arizona Cardinals. You know, flipped some houses back in college, degree in real estate, but really looking to network and connect with local entrepreneurs that are actually doing it as real estate investors. And I mean, maybe like 30 to 40 people must have gotten back to me. And I essentially just took them all out to lunch or coffee and just picked their brains up and down. And they graciously showed me the ins and outs of their systems, their properties and things like that. And like all along that process, I had found an awesome investor slash realtor who, you know, really, really took his time. His name's Ryan Swan, awesome realtor out in Phoenix, who really took his time out of his, just his process to teach me how to house hack. And I had found a nice fourplex, in Northern Phoenix. Nice is kind of a really far-fetched way of saying it. It's a solid fourplex in a C minus neighborhood in Northern Phoenix. You know, I got crap from my teammates, you know, cause all those guys are living in, you know, Tempe, Scottsdale, Paradise Valley, living in some, you know, Paradise Valley. You're spending almost $1.5 million on like a ranch just because you're in Paradise Valley. And I was like, you know, I don't need to do that. I knew what this could do and how it could set me up essentially for life, just with that low barrier of entry by using an FHA loan. So I bought a fourplex, you know, lived in one unit, rented out the other three, and it was awesome. I cash flowed maybe $100 while living there, and it set me up for when I inevitably got cut. I took that unit I was living in and Airbnb'd it and went to the Detroit Lions. And then when I got to Detroit, I did the same exact thing with a duplex in Allen Park. Me and my fiance, we lived downstairs and we Airbnb'd upstairs and completely covered our mortgage and cash flowed like $40 maybe while living there. And it was awesome. And while I was there, I was really just leveraging a bunch of different relationships and connections in Detroit. Found a few business partners that, you know, we really liked, trusted and respected each other, and have kind of went on to do a couple of bigger things and working on a bunch of bigger projects now. Like we're heading out to Germany at the end of May to start an opportunity zone fund amongst a bunch of different markets across the United States. But now currently what I'm doing on my own, we've identified a few markets across the country looking for C-level value add multifamily properties like everybody else in that 20 to 100 unit range. Just been building teams, building out my queue of brokers and property managers and attorneys and just a whole bunch of different team members in each market to really get the systems in place as I get ready to take off. That's kind of where I'm at today. Sorry, that was a very long-winded answer.
No, you covered everything. And I, you know, before our show, before our time here, I did a little research and discovered a good chunk of this stuff too, from stuff that you've put out there and everything. I mean, first of all, like my God, Hakeem, to go to Haiti. I went to Villanova. My mom works there. Her husband's a professor there, tenured professor.
Oh wow.
Yeah, so I'm from Philadelphia. Now I live in Chicago. I moved out of here so I could be near my, at the time, she was 12-year-old daughter. Now she's like 17, getting ready to go back to Villanova here in a year or so.
Oh, wow. Wow.
But wow, the whole experience in Haiti and coming face-to-face with death in those moments there is something that you managed to turn into a gift that you've been able to leverage, which is, it's remarkable to see that transformation on the heels of something so traumatic and horrible that I'd never wish anybody to go through. I mean, hats off for being able to convert that. That's not how everyone would have handled a situation like that.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I mean, it was rough for a decent stint, you know, when we got back, you know, seeing – It's a weird situation to be in. You know, you're supposed to be this big macho Division I football player, and now you're overnight, you're just a vulnerable person who, you know, anybody can be got to. You know, we're thinking, you know, we're in this country, providing value, giving out medicine, helping people. And then just like that, at the snap of a finger, you know, you're face down, facing death right in the eye.
I think I haven't had a face-to-face with death experience myself, but, you know, I've been lucky over the last 6-7 years to realize that my life is short, that I'm going to die, to really, like, know that's coming down the pike. And, like, as a result of that realization, I do not want to waste a single moment ever. Like, never. It's like every moment's got to count. Everything I'm doing and spending time with people, I really try to be present. And, like, I've been fortunate enough here at Diamond Equity Investments, the company that I founded back in 2006. Like, we've grown to, like, 16 partners spread throughout Atlanta, Chicago, Philadelphia. And we did, in profit last year, we did gross profit, like, $3.5 million spread out across that. So we've, like, gotten some really good momentum and started doing things.
That's
and
awesome.
I know for a fact, Hakeem, that would not have been possible with my attitude prior to that. I'm 38 years old now. It was like 31, 32. Around that time, I picked up the Bible. I really gave myself back to my faith, cleaned up my life, quit drinking, quit smoking cigarettes, the whole nine. Started working out and got like that, I would guess, probably not as intense of discipline, but like a certain level of discipline that you must have had to become a professional athlete in the gym, working out, complete lifestyle, dedication to that. I would say that's what I did around, you know, 32, 33 years old. I finally woke up and like kind of shed the skin of, oh, yeah, you know, I got my whole life to do this. It's sort of like a latent procrastination I see so many people struggle with. You know, who go on and maybe have dreams that aren't really coming true and they're not really getting stuff done in a way. So I guess the lesson or the takeaway for anyone listening, it's like, hey, man, you know, life does not last forever. Let's make sure we're making our time count here. You mentioned another thing, too, I just want to touch on real quick. Hakeem, I'm sure people are saying, yeah, Hakeem, the NFL player, it's real easy for him to go on Bigger Pockets and make an announcement and get 30 replies. And people take them out to lunch and everything like that. But I want to point out that, you know, like it would be hard to get someone like me to come out and do that kind of stuff at all in Bigger Pockets. But there's a lot of people who don't have the responsibility of 16 partners and humongous business who are doing real estate deals and what in markets all over the country. Bigger Pockets is a great tool. And if you put a post on there with the right kind of, you know, humility and ask of the universe, if you will, for a little assistance, you might not get the same 30 replies that Hakeem got, but you will get enough and you can really make some relationships with people and get started there. A lot of great information on Bigger Pockets.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. I didn't mean to cut you off. I was saying I agree with you so much with that, man.
For sure, man. And because I know people are going to say that, oh, well, if Hakeem did it, you know, he's the NFL guy. I'm just somebody who's not. So I kind of wanted to point that out. And like the other thing you did for 4 hours a day, consuming the real estate knowledge, I did that. I still do that. My own information diet, I watch as much as the diet of food that I take in. And like I have to pay attention to a lot of different areas in my life to maintain the momentum that we've built in our company. And I see a lot of people who are getting started who don't pay enough attention to like other areas of where they're spending their time. Maybe they're not really, you know, oh, I'm trying real estate, but they're not spending 4 hours, 5 hours listening to podcasts, taking notes, figuring out how to build that mindset. That's why I do the podcast, Hakeem. It's a give back. You know, I don't do coaching. I don't sell mentorships here. My listeners know I'm not pitching products and, you know, tapes and CDs or anything. Yeah, this is like, you know, I get to talk to people like you on here, record it and share that with the audience. And we do our best, you, me, both try to bring great knowledge to the people listening the same way that, you know, you were discovering that years ago. And like I've been doing that the same way for years myself. Would you mind sharing your perspective on, I know it was like the face-to-face with death that kind of was the turning point. But what kind of discipline do you approach your business with, and how did you approach the discipline with getting to the level that you did in the NFL? And is there a correlation of that exercise of the discipline muscle that you developed on the heels of that turning point that you know is now helping you and you expect to continue to help help you as you build momentum in the real estate business?
Absolutely. The discipline is critical. And when it comes to like cliches, I like to just throw them all out the window because I think a lot of cliches are just so true and people just, you know, wave them off as, oh, it's just a cliche. Yeah, yeah, whatever. Like I'll take you back to like me personally, like my passion when it comes to sports was always basketball. I always had hoop dreams, always wanted to go to the NBA. Like that was my thing. So I'll take you back to middle school. They cut sports from our middle school from the budget. And, you know, I always wanted to go to the NBA. I wanted to go to Duke University because I knew a lot of Duke guys went to the NBA, just being practical. So, I mean, my bus came, for example, in middle school at like 6:15 a.m. I asked my dad, I said, look, I need to get better at basketball because, like, I was in this league after school. There was just games and we didn't really practice. So, I mean, I was waking up at 4:15 to 4:30 every single morning. And my dad used to take me to LA Fitness and I used to get my shots up, get my mid-range shots, my free throws. And then I put these things on the bottom of my feet that were called jump soles to strengthen your calves so I could eventually dunk because I wanted to dunk. And like it really just came down to just putting that work in because I've never, ever, ever considered myself to be talented or to be that best person on the team. But back to the cliches, and they say, you know, hard work beats talent. When talent doesn't work hard, that's what it came down to. And then like moving forward, I'll just give you a couple more examples of just discipline. Like when I got to college, for example, you know, when I made that move to tight end, I knew that one, I had an opportunity. This NFL thing is a shot. And when it came down to just getting my catches in, like getting hands in, doing like different hands drills, I'd 500 to 1,000 balls a day. And wow. I'm talking when it comes to discipline, you went to Nova, so you know Penn State. And have you ever heard of like Arts Fest at Penn State?
Yep.
So it's a, you know, huge party time, good time for everybody. And this is just a very vivid moment in my life. I was just talking to one of my best friends about it. So me and all, like three of my roommates were all planning to go out to Arts Fest because we had a friend who went to Penn State. But I didn't finish getting my catches in for the day. So I literally held up the entire caravan, everyone going out there, because I had to get my catches in before we go out here and, you know, go party away for the weekend. And then you go to another level of discipline. When I moved to tight end, I was a wide receiver. And I had to put on a lot of weight to become a tight end. I put on about 30 to 40 pounds in a month and a half. And that was every single meal. I was eating 5 slices of pizza to end with. I'd end every meal with a bowl of cottage cheese with crushed up celery in it because cottage cheese has a just disgusting level of protein and fat in it. I was doing like creatine. There's like a loading phase of creatine where you need to take it about 5 times a day, I believe. But like, I'm so practical. I knew that had to happen no matter what. Doesn't matter what's going on. You better be taking 5 scoops of creatine and you can't drink alcohol with it. So for example, it was one of my buddy's birthday parties. We went down to Atlantic City and, you know, we're partying, having a good time. I wasn't drinking, but I realized I didn't take my 5th scoop of creatine. It's like 1:30 in the morning. And I literally left the club, went to the hotel parking garage to go to my car to go grab my creatine to go make sure I got that last sip of creatine. Because I personally believe that it's small things like that that separates you from that next guy. And then you go into just moving forward, you know, that all was happening. And then that life-changing experience happened. And that was just like, damn, like you really got to double down on just being disciplined, making sure, you know what I'm saying? Like if this NFL thing's going to happen, you need to literally do every single thing. Like I made it a point. Any person that I knew that was in the NFL, anybody who came to the training facility that I was at that was in the NFL, I would pick their brains up and down and ask them every single type of advice that they could give to a young NFL player like myself. And I mean, you know, they always say the cliche is, you know, show up first and be the last one to leave the building. Like some people say it, but like who's actually doing it? Like, I mean, I was showing up first person in there, so I could get my hot tub, cold tub, stretch out, get my roll, like the foam rollers in on all my muscles. Then I would, you know, we'd work out from like 7 to 11, on just different combine drills and things like that. 11 to 12, we'd watch film. 12 to 4, we'd do, strength training and a little bit of like, work on your craft, whatever your position was. And then there was a quarterback coach who was training a bunch of quarterbacks in that same building as mine. So I went up to him. I said, "Hey, I see you're having to move around and like you have to catch for your quarterback clients and you're not actually being able to focus on themselves. So what's your thoughts on if I just actually stand in place for you, do your catches for you, and you can instruct all your clients?" Because I just wanted to catch as many balls as possible. And there's a lot of guys, and like this isn't NFL quarterback. These are high school kids. And like most guys in my position wouldn't do that. It's like, oh, I'm a hot shot about to go to the NFL. What am I doing catching high school balls with high school kids? And I'm like, a ball is a ball. If you're going to catch it, you're going to catch it, and hands are hands regardless. You can catch a small ball, you can catch a bigger ball. So I'd spend another 2-2.5 hours with him and his clients just spotting up at different spots along the turf, just catching balls for them, hundreds and hundreds of, until like, I mean, I'd go through a pair of gloves maybe a week or a couple days because I'd rip them because so many balls I was catching. And moving forward, you know, I'd be finishing up with that and I'd look around. I'm like, there's no one else here. And then I would go, I'm like, this is those moments, like a piece of advice, I guess, for your audience. Those moments when you realize that you're doing those crazy and wild asinine things and then you see no competition with you, that's when you know you're doing it right and you should be double downing on it. So then I go back to the tubs, do a contrast bath on the tubs, then do back to the foam rollers and get my muscles right again. I got to the facility around 7 a.m. and maybe leave around 6:30, 7 p.m. and then really get back to my house at college, maybe watch one episode of Netflix with all my roommates and then go to bed and do it. Oh, I did that 6 days a week from January until the draft. So about 4.5 months, like that was my life. But it takes that level of discipline. I mean, from a numbers perspective, I was at 18% body fat when I started. When I finished, I was at like 9.5.
Whoa.
Yeah, like just from like the before and after pictures are insane. I look like a squirrel in terms of how chunky my cheeks are. And then at the end, like I lost all that body fat, but I also put on 3 pounds. Like it was like a wild, wild transformation. Like every meal, for example, at first I couldn't afford the, they had like a meal prep service that they offered at the thing. So my mom graciously would spend like 4 or 5 hours on Sundays, that was the off day, and chop up all the food, do all that, and meal prepped for 4 months straight. Like didn't eat anything outside of that diet, and just like that's what it takes. And then when I made it to the NFL, it's same exact thing, you know, in the tubs in the morning, doing all your stuff that you got to do during the day, and then back in the tubs afterwards. And then what else can you do? Can you catch balls? Can you do this? Can you do that? And kind of just take it from there. But when it comes to discipline now in my real estate business and how that actually happened while I was in the NFL as well, most guys in the league, they do what they got to do in terms of football. And then it, you know, 3-4 o'clock when your day's over at the facility, it's, you know, go watch some Sports Center, watch some more football, have a nice dinner, watch whatever game is on, go to bed and do it all over again. And in a sense, define themselves by the sport. What I'd recommend and what I did was double down on what I was passionate about, which was real estate. So from those hours from, you know, 4 to, didn't really matter what time for me, because all I needed is 6 hours of sleep, I was grinding. Do you know what I'm saying? Like when I was in Arizona, I was, as soon as the day ended, I was taking an investor out to coffee or out to lunch or checking out their properties or meeting different, you know, property managers or other investors in the area. Or, I mean, I can't, like the amount of books that I've read since I've been in the NFL versus before the NFL is actually like exponentially different in terms of, I read so many more while I was in the NFL. And just really, really, because I mean, all the secrets are in books. You're going to find things that you can't find on Google in books, because it's there on purpose because most people won't do it. You know what I'm saying? And kind of, you know, really just leveraging myself while I was in the league as a real estate investor. But because, you know, as an athlete, as a current athlete, like I'm self-aware enough to know that most people wouldn't really want to meet with me if I'm just some random newbie real estate investor. But the fact that I was in the NFL, it's awesome that, you know, a mayor of a city will meet with you at the drop of a dime. The governor will sit down and meet with you whenever and things like that. And, you know, you take advantage of it. You take advantage of the lifetime of an opportunity during the opportunity of a lifetime during the lifetime of that opportunity, which was, you know, only 2.5-3 years. Because me personally, I was never crazy passionate about football. Like football was never my, like I told you, basketball was my first love. I just knew from that process of going to college, I knew I was going to be able to get a scholarship for football. I knew I was not as good at basketball as I was naturally at football. And like, you know, back to the, you know, you said, you know, he's just in the NFL, like he's lucky because he's in the NFL. You know, I hate when people say that. Like I don't consider myself lucky. I know what it's taken for me to get here. Like the work it's been putting in, like now I wouldn't say this is the fruits of my labor because I'm still grinding. You know what I'm saying? Like now, for example, in terms of discipline, like I have a 7-month-old daughter and that changes everything. So, you know, in the mornings I wake up with my daughter, and then when my fiance wakes up, you know, she kind of takes over, and then I'm doing real estate stuff. And then I'm back with my daughter again. But then when she's asleep around 7-8 o'clock, from 8 to about 1:30, 2 a.m., I'm grinding. And I challenge any of your listeners to email me or call me at those hours, 1, 2 in the morning, I'll be answering. Because that's personally what it takes, because, you know, we all get the same 24 hours in a day. And, you know, people complain like, oh, I got a 9-to-5. Like, you know, 9-to-5 is only, what, 8 hours a day? Like, what are you, you know, there's 24 hours and you only really need 6-7 hours of sleep. It really comes down to what are you willing to sacrifice to get the results that you want. And like, I'm results oriented, but I think those results come from grinding. You know, some people get lucky and get things handed to them, but as you talk to more and more successful people and surround yourself with more successful people, you'll realize that it wasn't luck that got them there. Unless you're just an early investor in like Facebook or something like that, you're working your tail off to get the results that you want. And I mean, you can attest to that yourself, you know, with your real estate company. It's all about hard work.
Yeah, I really appreciate the whole perspective, that whole dedication, the drive, the sacrifice. You mentioned sacrificed everything to become who I am now. And that was like the perspective early on. I want to point out that real estate is a little bit deceptive in a sense that some half-assed people who don't put this same level of, you know, burning desire and passion that you just described, you know, that same level of like getting it done, and attention to the detail and a willingness to do what nobody else will, you can get away with and get lucky a little bit here and there from the perspective of average people. Someone could go out and make, you know, 60, 80, 100 grand a year doing real estate deals. And a lot of the people around them or people who are just getting started would look at that person and think, man, that guy's so successful. He's flipping, you know, flipped 3 houses this year. Wow. And so there's like, because it's a large ticket item, real estate, like I've tried a couple different businesses myself. I did the lawn mowing. I was knocking on the doors, you know, 8, 9 years old, borrowed the money to buy the lawnmower, that kind of thing. Had a bunch of other businesses along the way that I like failed out of and tried some stuff. And like the economics of the real estate business for most people, the real estate expense, that $2,000 a month you spend on the apartment, the $3,000 a month your brother was spending, it may not be to you and him at the time with the money that you were making, but to the average person, the money they're spending on rent is their single largest expense. And for a lot of people, the mortgage payment is the single largest expense. And the house that these people buy and then move up to, these are big events when they sell a house and move into a bigger house, people throughout the course of their life. This is the biggest ticket item that a lot of people are going to have come through their, you know, asset column of their account there if they're looking at their net worth of their entire life. So like this big ticket item of real estate allows people who would operate and get some success or some traction, even at like a lower level, you can still be like really successful. But if you want to take it to a whole nother level and get like a really consistent amount of momentum, the stuff you're talking about, you know, ice baths and not particularly for the listeners, I'm not saying you got to go out and do these ice, not exactly the workout, but it's like that mindset. If you can translate that into the real estate thing, for me, working out's still a part of it. 4 days a week with a trainer, 3 days a week with a trainer, couple days with cardio, I can think better. My willingness to stay up a little later, get the next marketing campaign done, put together the podcast, but every little thing. Sometimes you're not going to feel like doing it. You have to get up and do it. And that's what I think like the listeners should be taking away from that entire description of the discipline that you just kind of described. Does that make sense?
It makes complete sense. And like, I think one thing, my takeaway from that is that this life isn't for everybody. Like, you know, some people, you know, it's a wishy-washy dream of doing this and dream of doing that, but the actual grind of it, if you're not about that grind, like this life is not, like it's not for everybody. And like, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with, you know, living a 9-to-5 or doing things like that or, you know, renting, but don't come to me complaining about that life if you're not willing to put the work in to get the life that's going to, you know, afford you to live like most can.
Well said. So let's switch gears here a little bit. We've defined the mindset. We talked about the NFL. I know people wanted to hear about that. I want to hear about personally the, you mentioned the QOZ, the Opportunity Zone Fund. Can you, for people who, I know a little bit about the Opportunity Funds, but can you do a quick defining of what the Opportunity Fund is and maybe just what would be kind of the structure of a few or one of the deals, an avatar of the deal that you would plan on executing inside of the Opportunity Fund that you're working on?
Yes. So from the deal perspective, I actually can't go into that one deal that we're working on just from an NDA perspective. But from an opportunity zone, essentially what it is it's like a 1031 exchange on steroids, in my opinion. I think back in during the 2010 census, the government decided different areas across the country that, you know, needed help, needed essential parts of, you know, being redeveloped and some capital to be injected in those areas. So I think it was June of 2018 is when your listeners can correct me. I'm probably wrong. Is when the official rules finally came out. And what it says is in any qualified area that's, you know, if you just look it up on the, I don't know if it's the IRS website, I'm not sure which website, it has like a full blown map of neighborhood to neighborhood, what's in the opportunity zone and what's not. And what it says is, an investor can take any capital gains, whether it came from stocks, real estate, you know, selling a car, selling your house, selling anything like that, and put it in a qualified fund. And from a investor perspective, what qualifies you as a opportunity fund is you're working on a property that's, you know, for layman's terms and square numbers terms, say the property costs $1 million, but the land is worth $500,000 and the building's worth $500,000. You as an investor now have to put $500,000 that the property value's worth back into that building to now qualify the funds that are in that, the capital gains that are in that fund to now come out on the back end of it tax free. And the capital gains that are in the fund have to stay in that fund for 10 years in order to reap the benefits of the full tax-free perspective. I think if it's 7.5 years, you're going to get like a smaller tax, 5 years, larger tax. I think 5 years might be the shortest amount of time. But essentially, I mean, like I was saying, it's like a 1031 on steroids because, you know, a 1031, you can trade up your whole life. And then the loophole is, you know, pass it off to your kids and that tax disappears. But with this, it's only 10 years and then you get that money back tax free. So it's like, in my opinion, it's almost like, it's like a legal way of washing your money in terms of taxes.
Yeah, I think Sean Parker was a big pusher for this, and he was lobbying and was an instrumental part in getting it put through the process. The early Facebook guidance guy or the Napster guy. Oh, okay. Early on. And a big reason why this was sold to Washington in the first place, the Opportunity Zone, was to try and get people like the Facebook founders that you mentioned getting lucky, somebody who was an early investor and they made, you know, you bought into a stock at $20 and now it's Amazon and it's 10 years later and it's selling for whatever it is, $1,500 a share or something. Yep. So, you know, the thinking in Washington was to get somebody like that to be willing to sell off, you know, not the entire stake, but they could sell off $1 million, $2 million worth of that stake. Some of these people not take very much money off the table, but then delay and avoid and potentially wash the gain on that, which I think, of those, we would probably be looking at, I don't know, $2 million, maybe $300,000 to $350,000 in capital gains. If I had to guess, I'm probably off on my number. But by putting that and encouraging that to go into the opportunity zones, we're looking as a country to try to rebuild, reinvest, you know, stimulate the economies in those areas, be it in real estate or other type of investments. I think there might even be some business investments too. I didn't read the entire, you know, prospectus for the opportunity zone. For me, it was a little bit of a heavy lifting issue. We sort of are in and out of properties fast, 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, 12 months max. You know, yep. We do 200 of them a year. So it's kind of like it's not really, we're not holding them for 10 years. So this wasn't something I dove deep into. I know you can't talk about, because of the NDA, the exact deal that you have cooking. But like, what overall, let's say you got the fund set up, you, the partners, et cetera. What are going to be the target type of deals, and how do you think those deals are going to be profitable? How do you see those deals, you know, playing out? Are you buying office buildings there? Are you doing, you know, multifamily convert? Like, what is the target deal that
larger,
you're looking for?
Larger multifamily buildings, for example, and just because the main reason why we don't want to talk about this, because we don't want to, the area that it's in, we just don't want to create speculation before the actual, you know, project and fund takes off. But for example, we're actually converting a old factory slash, there's a museum at the base of the factory, because it's a historical landmark, and converting that into 80 apartment units, and then, you know, holding it obviously, you know, for 10 years. But it's in the city it's located in, it's a it has a strong sentimental value to the people in that city. So, you know, we're keeping a lot of the aspects of the warehouse and keeping the museum in place, and then adding 80 units on top of it. And it, you know, the purchase price, we've been just back and forth with negotiation. I think we're going to buy it for about $3.2 million. And the conversion, I can't remember what the total construction costs are. I'm not sure if we've even bidded them out yet. But it's going to be a smoking deal. And just from the perspective of what it's going to do to that city, and that area of that city, it's going to be just major, major impact. And I'm terribly sorry I can't give, you know, details out on that.
Yeah, no worries. I appreciate that. So will that be the only deal, or will you guys be seeking additional deals to round out that fund's commitment?
Oh, no, we're going to be seeking plenty of deals with it. Our major focus is securing the capital first. And that's all. So the pitch is, you know, some people start the funds and, you know, put a whole bunch of investors in there. My partner has a strong relationship with a family office out in Germany who actually already injects about $450 million of capital in the United States every year. And our pitch and our goal is to you know, take those capital gains off of those, you know, because they're doing it with single family houses, actually. Which is a lot in my opinion. And take those capital gains, you know, from that $450 million you're injecting and roll that over into this fund. And it's like you said, it's like washing the money.
So if there's somebody listening who has some money, what would be the kind of investor who would raise their hand if they're listening to our conversation, Hakeem? Like price point, accredited investor, minimum investment, what would be like the returns on that that an investor like that could expect?
On that, so on our fund from a returns perspective, I'm a genuine full disclosure guy. We actually haven't finalized those exact numbers yet because we actually just met with that family office's attorney to figure out how they structure all of their own personal deals. And then essentially tailor that to their specifications. You know, some people, and I'm sure most of your listeners know that some people almost jump the gun too soon on what they're going to give their investors. You know, from a perspective of, like, with me, with my personal smaller 20 to 100 unit properties that I'm working on, you know, some people will come out off the jump saying, oh, we're going to offer you an 8 pref and then do a, you know, 50-50 split afterwards. Where in reality, you might not have necessarily had to do that. They might have just been fine with equity. So we take the perspective of actually learning about that investors and their goals first and then tailoring your product to that. But with the fund, because we're only using one single investor, like I said, we just met with that family office's attorneys to now figure out how we're going to actually tailor the returns and the structure of the fund in terms of acquisition fees and asset management fees and all of that. So all of that it's actually not set in stone yet. So I hate to, you know, not have that answer for you, but I'm not going to sit here and BS you.
On the 20 to 100 unit buildings that you're working on now, are these value add opportunities with like lower hold times than the opportunity zone deals?
Yeah, they're value add. We're telling investors to expect to, keep their money in the deals from 5 to 7 years, just because as we all know, there's a looming correction coming in the near future. So plan to buy it right, hold it through the correction, and dispose of it as the market makes its way back up.
Yeah, I've been told that too when I'm raising money, and some of the listeners know it's a topic that we have often come up here. I define mine up front. It's more like for us, we're flipping these houses, we're in and out in 6 to 9 months, 12 months.
Gotcha.
We do 2 points origination and 10% interest paid out on a balloon when we sell the property. So why do I pay so much when I have lenders who will do it for, like, let's say 7.5-8% with 1 point? I'll pay a little more for two reasons, Hakeem. I'd like to think of my private lenders, the people who participate on my deals, in a sense like my business partners. Like, I'm looking out for these people. I'm not thinking of them like, like a bank might think of their depositors, more like I might think of somebody, one of my 16, you know, go-to partners. So we really try to have that, like I'm kind of trying to look out for my private lenders, and, you know, some of them make really good money at the end of the year with the way we structure them. And that just works out for me. I kind of have a little bit of a push, if you will, like you have with the NFL opening doors. My podcast opens doors with my private investors. They get to know me, they get to see who I am, and they can sit back and watch me, you know, the same way someone can sit back and watch you being the NFL guy from a distance, in a sense, and get a little bit of a feel of who I am from the podcast. So, like, if I were on my own having the face-to-face conversation with investors one-on-one, as opposed to on a show, on a platform like this, like anyone listening, as an example, if you don't have the podcast, I would suggest the way that you're talking about raising money, Hakeem, where you're kind of doing a little bit more of discovery with the lender to see what they expect to participate in a deal. If you can kind of get away with that, it's definitely a negotiation that's open to be had, if you will, right?
Absolutely.
Cool. All right, I'm going to switch gears here. We'll do a little wrap up. Is there anything I forgot to ask you that you feel like I should have asked you that you think the listeners could gain value from, Hakeem?
Let me think. I think we touched on about everything as I kind of went on a ramble there.
All right, cool. So I got a question here that I'd like you to answer two ways, Hakeem. Book recommendations you would make to somebody who was kind of maybe just getting started, let's say, in a real estate game, and maybe one that you would make to somebody a little more advanced. They don't have to be real estate related books. It could be business or something that you just found really impactful in general that you think might be relevant to the audience.
I would say the first book from a beginner's perspective, I would recommend The Go-Giver. Essentially just to shift that person's mindset into the, you know, how do I add value? How do I give without expecting to receive anything? To essentially ignite them to now reach out to people in the real estate industry, if that's their aspiration. And now instead of asking them, what can you, in going in, into it with the mindset of what can I get out of this person? What can I get out of Hakeem? What can I get out of Dan? After sitting down with him for coffee, after he reached out to me after this Bigger Pockets post, and shift that mindset of how can I add value to Hakeem? How can I add value to Dan? How can I add value to this real estate investor who's doing things that I want to do? And now the conversation, the energy just completely shifts. And now you might not get anything out of it. But if you don't, I mean, you added some good to the universe. If not, it'll come back tenfold to you. For a more advanced person, I'd recommend Multifamily Millions by David Lindahl. I think it really expands in one book exactly kind of a blueprint of how to really get started in the multifamily world and kind of break some of the stigmas that are surrounded in the multifamily world. But I really love that book.
Nice. You mentioned the Go-Giver and how do I add value. We had somebody who came, they found Diamond Equity through the podcast. And mm-hmm. I share this story often. The guy's name is Austin Stack, and he was adding value. He would send me, he moved from Chicago to Atlanta. So I met him in Chicago. He came out to one of our networking events, said hello, and he was like brand new, you know, he's sending me over listed properties and trying to make $5,000 on top of the listing price kind of thing, because he just didn't really mm-hmm. understand the business. But he kept trying to connect me with sellers, with buyers, contractors, et cetera. We fast forward like maybe a year or so. Finally, he caught my attention, and I don't know that he was really doing it on purpose. He was like you were describing. It wasn't like it was done with the aim of, oh, I want to be in business with Dan Breslin. He was just simply trying to add value, and this is the kind of guy he is with me and with everyone else around him as well. But we ended up doing the Atlanta thing together. He's a vice president there, and we did like $1 million in the first 14 months together. So it turned into like a really valuable relationship for both of us. And it started off because he had that attitude of just like giving, not to the point where you're discounting yourself and damaging yourself. You're giving so much. But you definitely want to find ways to try to add to the relationships and bring something to the table. You'll get people's undivided attention if it ends up being something that truly is valuable.
Absolutely. 100%.
Cool. If you could go back, share the crown jewel of wisdom with your 18-year-old self, Hakeem, what would that be?
Because I was 18, I was just going to college. I would say my 18-year-old self. I'd say my 18-year-old self, I'd just say, just make sure you stop to take a breath and actually, you know, soak in the view. You know, sometimes, like, and it's kind of contrary to everything else I was saying about, you know, grind. But I also think that the success throughout the grind is found on the journey, not necessarily the destination. And a lot of people get caught up with that destination and turn off all of the vibrations on the scene that's going on throughout that journey to that destination. And in reality, that success is that hard work and that determination and that process of you getting to that destination. So I think my recommendation, my advice to myself is just, I mean, I was always aware and self-aware, but open your eyes a little bit more and really, really just take it all in and soak it all in.
Nice. If people are listening and want to get in touch with you, maybe reach out and add some value, what would be the best way for them to get in contact with you?
My email address, it's my first name and last name, Hakeem Ballas, and then .invest@gmail.com. That's probably the very best way. And then my social media handles, I respond to everything, all DMs, all comments on my pictures. On my Instagram and Twitter, the same exact handle. It's HAK, the first three letters of my first name. Then my last name, Valles, V as in Victor, A-L-L-E-S, and then the number 80. So @HakValles80.
Nice. Do you want to make an ask or a request of the audience while you have the floor?
I'm personally looking for a social media manager here in the United States, just to help me out. Cause I always think that, you know, some people outsource their entire social media stuff. And I don't think you can outsource your personal brand because it's a personal brand. But I'm looking in the market for someone to help me in some terms of just guidance and organizing my thoughts. And I've been on, like, since I retired, I've been on a just dropping just massive amounts of content because I'm, I guess that's one thing we didn't speak about. I'm also a professional speaker, and I've just been telling my story about, you know, that Haiti story, and then frame it into inspiring people to really just take advantage of everything we have today, whether it's technology, whether it's your time, whether it's you being in college. Maybe you should start networking with investors, so when you get out of college or while you're in college, you can maybe be a part of a property and now you don't get caught up in that rat race. But long story short, I've been breaking down a lot of content from all of my speeches and just blasting it out to all of my social media pages and kind of seeing not necessarily what sticks, but what the audience essentially likes, but not really caring about, you know, how many likes or views or whatever I get. Like, for example, me being on this podcast is the direct result of my first LinkedIn post. My first LinkedIn post got, I mean, it's currently still growing. It's like 65,000 views. And I was not expecting it, and I wasn't even going to post it on LinkedIn. But I just, you know, got quiet up top, said, who cares what people on LinkedIn think about me? They, you know, started out with maybe 300 connections before that post, and it kind of went crazy. And but I need kind of help of really just from a data perspective and really understanding what I'm actually doing with this, you know, social media thing. But yeah, that's probably my only ask, long ask.
All right. Hey, Hakeem, I know we ran over. I promised only to keep you an hour. It's been a little longer than that. I appreciate your time. I appreciate you making space here for, you know, sharing the story, the inspiration, the discipline, the motivation, you know, the whole nine. Just sharing of yourself today and adding value to the REI Diamond Show listeners. I really appreciate you.
Absolutely, Dan. I really appreciate you having me on the show and you know, allowing me to share my story with your audience. You guys have an awesome platform, and I'm excited to really dive down into some of your previous episodes as well.
And thank you for tuning in to this episode of the REI Diamond Show. Keep an eye out for next week's episode. Economist and financial advisor Paul Sloat joins us to discuss the second quarter market outlook of 2019. Paul brings good news for us real estate investors in complete contrast to much of the recession and correction talk that I've been hearing lately. I am personally advised by Paul on my investments, and it's helped me make outstanding gains in my real estate investment activities and continuing to invest with confidence when I hear a ton of negative news out there. You definitely want to catch that episode. Now, are you interested in the pre-release of the next episode? That is, before the email goes out? When you subscribe on YouTube or one of the podcasting apps, including iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher, you'll receive an advance notification as soon as episodes are published, as opposed to Saturday when the email is sent. If you prefer the email, just head on over to reidiamonds.com and sign up. I am always buying houses, and I am always looking for deals in Chicago, Atlanta, and Philadelphia. So if you have a deal for sale, gotta be profitable, preferably a fix and flip deal, please send it over. You can contact me directly at reidiamonds.com using the form at the bottom right. Also from that site, you can check out profitable real estate deals and the entire archive of REI Diamond shows totaling more than 129 content-rich, money-making, idea-packed episodes. This concludes this episode. Thanks again for tuning in to the REI Diamond Show. I appreciate you being here. Dan Breslin here. Catch you on the next one.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.